Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, April 9th. I'm Lisa Music reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, wind energy transmission upgrades could reach $5 billion. Eureka's 1.25% Measure H sales tax is buying a lot of infrastructure. And Mendocino Board of Supervisors dubious about gas station proposal. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. Upgrading the region's power transmission system to accommodate offshore wind energy will cost billions of dollars. Daniel Mentz reports.
Offshore wind farms will significantly boost clean energy production, but the Humboldt County region's power transmission system will need to be upgraded, a project that could cost up to $5 billion. The power transmission and capacity needs of offshore wind energy were detailed in a March 25th webinar by the Schatz Energy Research Center at Cal Poly Humboldt. In late 2022, two wind energy developers emerged as winners in a federal bidding process for areas 21 miles offshore of Eureka, encompassing more than 132,000 acres. The two bids totaled more than $331 million, but the cost of redeveloping power infrastructure to carry higher loads will be far more than that. Arnie Jacobson, Schatz's director, said local transmission capacity needs to be exponentially increased.
Just focusing in on the Humboldt wind energy area for the moment and thinking about a system that has an output of 1,800 megawatts, or a wind farm that has installed capacity of 1,800 megawatts, that installed capacity is about 20 times the export capacity of the existing lines serving Humboldt County. So large-scale expansion of the transmission system would, of course, be needed to be able to deliver offshore wind to major load centers that would be able to absorb that power. The estimated cost for upgrading the transmission system in our analysis is on the order of $2 to $5 billion, depending on the specifics, with the systems based on more conventional AC transmission lines being towards the less expensive side of things and undersea high-voltage DC transmission being towards the upper end.
The cost factor was brought up during a question and answer session. Jacobson said wind energy developers will be responsible for covering the costs of loan financing for the investments, but power customers cover the bulk of the costs. The impact on local ratepayers could be blunted, however, if the wind energy project is deemed to be in the interest of the entire state.
The bidder would be responsible for financing, but ultimately ratepayers cover that cost in the long term. And that's true essentially of all costs associated with the electrical system, unless it's possible to obtain federal funding to partially offset some of those costs. Ultimately, ratepayers are covering those costs. I think a really important distinction or nuance, though, is that when a particular piece of infrastructure is identified as being in the interest of the state, so from a policy perspective, it is being recommended, it's the ratepayers across the entire state that are covering that cost, not the ratepayers from a particular region. And so that would be spread across the entire California rate base. And, of course, the people living in the Humboldt region or in northwestern California make up a pretty small fraction of that rate base, so the cost is spread across the entire state.
Routing of transmission cables to power hubs in the San Francisco Bay Area is under study, and specific routes haven't been identified. If overland routing is chosen, existing power line rights of ways will likely be followed, but they'll have to be widened. Permitting issues would include environmental impacts, land ownerships, and wildfire risk. Benefits of upgrading include expansion of clean energy and improvement of power service reliability, but as explained by Jacobson during the question and answer session, areas of Humboldt County outside of its Humboldt Bay urban hub like Southern Humboldt, wouldn't see much improvement in electrical reliability because they're served by peripheral small capacity lines.
The first thing I'll say is that it's not that there's zero benefit to communities that are living on in areas that are served by these smaller lines that are running out from the region. It's just that the benefit is, when it comes to reliability and capacity, is limited by the capacity of those particular lines. And so to the degree that outages are caused by things that are happening in the Humboldt Bay area, those types of outages would be reduced for everyone in the region. But for outages that are caused by issues that are on the distribution system or on the radial lines themselves, having a stronger connection in the Humboldt Bay region would not address that particular issue.
But Jacobson added that development of site-specific microgrid and battery storage systems is also being looked at and could benefit the county's outlying areas. Summing up key points, Jacobson said offshore wind energy could contribute substantially to local and state clean energy production goals with significant investment needed in power infrastructure. He added that it will take deliberate steps for communities like Southern Humboldt to get the improvements in power service reliability that the county's Humboldt Bay region will see. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Metz.
The Eureka City Council adds more building restrictions to property owners and hears about the city's infrastructure upgrades. Kelly Lincoln reports.
The Eureka City Council directed staff to develop a design overlay for its zoning requirements, and the council heard a report from city engineers on a tremendous amount of infrastructure upgrades and repairs completed in 2023 and those underway in 2024 at the Eureka City Council Tuesday, April 2nd. For background to the design overlay, the site of the former Eureka Adult School is 8 acres known as the Jacobs property. Downtown businesses who will be impacted by Eureka's plans to convert downtown and Old Town parking lot into housing projects that will have no parking for their residents want the city to move some of the needed units over to the Jacobs property, which is in a residential neighborhood next door to a school and a 5-minute walk from Winco. The group gathered signatures and placed a Eureka Housing for All and Downtown Vitality initiative on the November ballot to let Eureka's voters decide whether they want parking downtown or a dense, low-car atmosphere. The group had hoped to get their initiative on the March primary ballot, but that wasn't possible. Rob Arkley backed a lawsuit trying to prevent a 50-unit apartment building with no parking from being developed on the city lot at 5th and D Street until voters could speak on the matter in November. In February, California Attorney General Bonta shamed Eurekans who have doubts about the city's downtown housing proposal. Bonta said, quote, "I proudly support Eureka City Council in opposing a cynical effort to hamper development projects that benefit low-income residents. I will not stand for it," end quote, as he filed an amicus brief on behalf of the city council against the lawsuit. And in the midst of this, an anonymous party made an offer with Eureka City Schools, who was trying to sell the property. But as of this date, that purchase has not moved forward. Subsequent to that offer, the city council held a town hall with Eureka residents to see what they hoped would be built on the Jacobs property. At Tuesday's meeting, Eureka's Development Services Director, Kristen Kenyon, explained.
We got the staff report from the town hall. The short answer was that there was no consensus on what people wanted to see as far as uses. There was a wide variety of what folks wanted to see, but there was a consistent response that they wanted public participation and transparency.
So this overlay would be exploring how to blend gently density into or adjacent to single family neighborhoods. And the neighborhood around the Jacobs campus would be one of a selection of neighborhoods explored when designing the overlay. It's adding additional standards or additional allowances on top of the existing base standards for it. So everywhere, every property in the city has a zoning district, be it service commercial or residential, and then this would be adding some design standards on top of that. Because the base zones are really focused on what uses are allowed, and then they give kind of a broad brush, you know, you're not allowed more than 22 dwelling units an acre. And 22 dwelling units an acre can look and feel very differently depending on how it's oriented to the street, how big the parcels are, how big the buildings are. And so this would be dealing with those design-related things.
The council voted to approve this process, and it will begin with a consultant being hired to help design the concepts and invite public participation. The other major item was hearing a report from City Engineer Jesse Willer on the capital improvement project. Projects include installing new water mains, paving, upgrading and replacing the pumps for the sewage collection system, fiber optic cable installation.
There along I Street, where we installed fiber optic between the high tank facility at Harrison K to the municipal auditorium. This project is intended to provide the backbone for our communication between a lot of our uses, whether that's fire and PD in future phases, or IT and public works communications for our infrastructure.
Eureka also has sewage discharge compliance monitoring they must complete to prevent stormwater infiltration.
The consent decree has a requirement that the city do three things to its collection system. It has to do closed circuit, television, manhole inspection, and smoke testing. So this project is breaking the city into two parts and looking at doing all those activities.
The former 2030 park behind the baseball field on Union Street is now named Dias Park.
Plaza, the parking lot, new restrooms, the fitness area, play areas. There's a central play area that has, amazing playground structures such as the playground equipment that you see here. Additionally, it has a multi-game area that will include roller and street hockey, half-court basketball, full-court basketball, futsal, and opportunities for art. So a lot of different really cool things that are going into this, and that construction is scheduled to start this spring.
And more controversial projects like the traffic calming project that will narrow H and I streets from three lanes down to two lanes, and the ongoing citywide construction of high-sided intersection bump outs designed to slow traffic, but that are also frequently called ankle busters by pedestrians, are moving forward. Eureka's Cooper's Gulch is getting large woody debris for salmonid habitat, and fish passage will be built.
This is the first slough, fish passage, floodplain restoration, and coastal habitat connectivity project. This project was funded by the Fisheries Restoration Grant Program. The entrance to Cooper Gulch Park, the skate park is there, and just to the north of that is where you see the beginning of the project, where we're looking at realigning the stream channel and including large woody debris through that section, as well as doing off-channel rearing habitat and refugia areas. These are all to support trying to reintroduce fish to the area, in particular salmonids. Heading up from there along the existing reach, along the backside of the park there, along where the disc golf course is, you'll see some additional large woody debris will be installed along the creek channel there. Then if you jump to the middle of the map at 14th Street, there's going to be a replacement to install a 12-foot diameter culvert, which will be fish passable. Upstream from there, additional large woody debris will be in place, again, for refuge and for grade control.
Eureka is also building a community housing project on the bay behind Pearson's, just south of the fire training area on Hilficker Lane.
It's community housing development at the Crowley site. This project includes constructing pre-manufactured housing units, which will include rooms or dwelling units, a kitchen building, a laundry building, shower and restroom buildings, and will be completed this summer.
Willer listed a dozen more projects, both completed and upcoming. Much of this work is being paid for by Eureka's Measure H, a 1.25 sales tax within Eureka that was approved in 2020. The entire Eureka City Council meeting is available on Access Humboldt. This is Kelly Lincoln reporting on the ongoing developments in the Humboldt County seat for KMUD News.
Southern Humboldt residents can receive a dump voucher from Caltrans and Clean California tomorrow at the Garberville Town Square from 3 to 6 p.m. Caltrans, through the Clean California program instituted by Governor Gavin Newsom after the pandemic in a bid to reduce litter and put Californians back to work, has a targeted three-prong approach to cleaning up the Sunshine State. Julia Peterson, Clean California coordinator, shared details about the program.
So on Wednesday, we will be at the Garberville Town Square. And I do believe Supervisor Bushnell will be joining us, and we'll have a Caltrans Clean California pop-up tent. We do have a limited number of individually numbered vouchers to hand out. It's first come, first serve, one per household, although there's no, you don't have to prove you live where you live or anything like that. We just, if you show up and you tell us you've got a household, we'll give you a voucher. We do typically run out of vouchers before the end of a voucher event. So I do recommend getting there early and we will give you a voucher. It'll say right on the voucher when you can go to the Redway transfer station.
Clean California has held several dump days throughout the region, identifying underserved areas that would benefit from dump vouchers due to economic hardships and high disposal costs. Each area has a unique need, and the voucher system was determined to be beneficial for Southern Humboldt.
So the large item dump day works for each community a little bit differently. In the Redway area, the transfer station really couldn't handle everyone coming to the transfer station with their trash on the same day. So we're going to be issuing vouchers. And there'll be a couple hundred vouchers for each of 2 weeks. So when you stop by Garberville Town Square to pick up a voucher, you can select which week you want to bring your trash. But it is good for a full load, as much as you can put in your vehicle, and the trailer's up to 15 feet.
In addition to litter removal and encouraging community cleanup, Clean California has focused on beautification projects that discourage further degradation of an area.
I don't have a lot of hard statistics, although after we painted the murals under the Samoa Bridge, the calls for service in the year after that decreased by 28% for the calls for police services. So we know that by beautifying the area, making it welcoming, and increasing pride in that particular area, it attracted more people, more usage, and did decrease crime and dumping.
There are restrictions to what can be disposed of, and those restrictions will be listed on the voucher that is good for disposing of a vehicle load or vehicle load plus up to a 15-foot trailer load of garbage at the Redway Transfer Station without charge.
We love our community. We love our state. The murals and the art also really improve pride in a community and make people feel part of the community.
The 3-year Clean California program is coming to an end.
As Clean California is sunsetting, it was a 3-year program, and it will sunset on June 30th of this year. The construction of the local grants and the beautification projects, that will continue on until those projects are finished. But we're hoping that this opportunity after the pandemic to really clean up, to experience a clean and beautiful environment, will help everyone to be encouraged to maintain it.
For those wanting to take advantage of the free dump day vouchers, they will be available tomorrow, April 10th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Garberville Town Square. Turning to Mendocino, a controversial gas station proposal in Redwood Valley faces scrutiny as county considers last-minute traffic study amid concerns over need, environmental impact, and owner's track record, prompting a heated debate before this Board of Supervisors. KZYX's Sarah Reith brings you the details.
A controversial gas station in Redwood Valley is due for another round before the Board of Supervisors next month, as county staff considers a last-minute traffic study submitted by the applicant. Mahmoud Alam of Faizan Corporation first won approval for a gas station in Redwood Valley at the bottom of the grade in 2016. Delays led into the pandemic and the expiration of the original permit. In late 2023, he applied again for a 10-pump station with a convenience store in the strip mall on the east side of Highway 101. He and his supporters say the area is in need of an anchor tenant who will revitalize economic activity. But the Redwood Valley Municipal Advisory Council, or MAC, and other neighbors say there are enough gas stations in the town, as well as the county, that approving a gas station will not support the county's goals of meeting the environmental crisis, and that Alam has racked up violations that make them leery of his businesses. The Planning Commission denied the new permit on January 5th. The next day, Alam's attorney appealed that on March 26th it came before the Board of Supervisors. County Council recommended that the board continue the item so that Caltrans and the county's Department of Transportation could analyze Alam's latest traffic study. His consultant, Daylene Whitlock of Westrans, sought to debunk an earlier Caltrans analysis, projecting that the station would engender 5,300 trips per day. Whitlock said that based on the activity at another gas station, also owned by Alum, trips would be under 1,000. The board voted unanimously to delegate Supervisors Glenn McCourty and Ted Williams to gather more information about more traffic at more gas stations to inform their telegraphed refusal next month. However, Caltrans appears to be standing firm on its insistence that Alum pay to close the median just to the north of the proposed station. That's to prevent collisions the agency fears would result from southbound travelers turning left off the freeway to get into the business. Alum says he won't build the station if he also has to build the median, which a local contractor said would cost $2 million. A letter from his attorney implies that Caltrans is in the wrong, trying to stick his client with the bill for a median closure that was well underway before plans for the gas station were revived. In spite of the convoluted minutiae of the now years-long saga, Dolly Riley, chair of the Redwood Valley MAC, says she and other neighbors are committed to their opposition.
Postponing this decision due to an appeal, we've all seen that in our national politics. You know, there may be a lot of money behind this gas station, but there's a lot of passion among the people in Redwood Valley. So we can kick this can down the road. We have the passion to be here and to continue to talk about it. Thank you.
Former Sheriff Tom Allman said that although the Coyote Valley Tribal Station and another station are nearby, the proposed station is the one that will provide a strategic advantage to first responders in need of a fill-up.
I remember, and I hope that you remember, when we've had emergencies in this county and we've run out of fuel. We've absolutely run out of fuel. This is an opportunity to have a state-of-the-art facility in Redwood Valley, a very strategic location where we are going to improve public safety. We're going to improve the south edge of the ridge. We're going to have travelers stop there. We're going to actually increase our sales tax by not having them stop on Lake County Highway 20. They're going to be northbound traffic is going to be spending their sales tax here. Hooray.
Alum owns gas stations all over the region. Last year, his company, Faison Corporation, was ordered to pay $500,000 for 64 environmental and business practice violations in 7 counties, including Mendocino. And in 2019, the California Regional Water Quality Control Board issued a cleanup and abatement order for groundwater contamination and improper disposal of hazardous waste at the Express Mart on Gobi Street in Ukiah. He says the fines were 100% housekeeping stuff, such as poor reporting on the part of tenants. He also said he was cleared of environmental damage on Gobi Street. Under questioning from Supervisor Maureen Mulhern, who was on the city council at the time, he said he had a disagreement with an environmental health inspector over what kind of testing was required in the vicinity of a city well. Pollutants were found in the groundwater, but not the well.
I spend millions of dollars to cleaning up the environment rather than, you know, polluting it. There's any proof if somebody can show me in any violations that there was contaminated by caused by us or any tanks was leaked during our operations, I can be responsible. And this can be verified by the environmental health.
But supervisors continued to be skeptical of the 170-page Westrans traffic analysis, which relied on data about trips to one of Alum's other gas stations. Williams questioned Whitlock, the consultant hired by Alum.
Do you compare it to one other business owned by the same entity?
Not normally.
Yeah. So something not normal has been submitted here because we didn't like the answer the Planning Commission gave. Everything else aside, just looking at the research method here, I don't think it has a lot of credibility. Sample size of one.
Supervisor Dan Jurdy also found the single source inadequate. He suggested using traffic to the two existing gas stations in Redwood Valley as comparisons.
The Chevron on Lake Mendocino Drive, visible from Highway 101, easily accessible from Highway 101. It's the second closest gas station to the proposed location, as well as Coyote, which is the closest gas station to this proposed location. It seems to me that trip traffics for those two gas stations should at least be considered in determining what is the appropriate trip traffic that this project would generate.
Alum objected to the suggestion that the Chevron gas he planned to sell be compared to the product at the Coyote Valley Casino, which was hotly defended by other community members.
So I consider Chevron as a Neiman Marcus or Nordstrom. So Nordstrom customers not going to go to Walmart, or neither the Walmart customers going to go to Nordstrom. So with the respect, I consider the casino is a Walmart. That's generic gas and all the stuff, so there'll be no comparison.
With Alum's attorney dropping references to the anticipated reasoning of a judge and county council advising a defensible record, the board voted to thoroughly document their denial of the project, which they plan to vote on at their meeting on May 7th. For KZYX News, I'm Sarah Reith.
In national news, the Supreme Court of the United States considers case limiting abortion pill access. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The case Food and Drug Administration versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine is the Supreme Court's first abortion access case since overturning Roe versus Wade in 2020. It involves a challenge to the FDA's approval of expanded access to the abortion pill mifepristone. The original Texas case ruled against the FDA's approval of mifepristone, leading to an appeals court ruling, and now the Supreme Court. U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prilligar argued on behalf of the petitioners, the FDA.
FDA approved mifepristone based on the agency's scientific judgment that the drug is safe and effective. It's maintained that judgment across five presidential administrations, and millions of Americans have used mifepristone to safely end their pregnancies. Respondents may not agree with that choice, but that doesn't give them Article III standing or a legal basis to upend the regulatory scheme.
The FDA approved mifepristone in 2000 for terminating early pregnancy. Since then, the FDA has made it more widely available and also removed the requirements for in-person visits with a doctor. Mifepristone was used in nearly two-thirds of all abortions in the United States last year. Prilligar says the FDA relied on dozens of studies involving thousands of women, unlike those challenging the drug.
Respondents don't identify any evidence that the agency overlooked. They just disagree with the agency's analysis of the data before it. But that doesn't provide a license to authorize judicial second-guessing of the agency's expert judgments.
The case was brought by seven anti-abortion doctors, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. Lawyer Aaron Hawley, with the conservative group Alliance Defending Freedom, argued on behalf of the seven doctors.
FDA's outsourcing of abortion drug harm to respondent doctors forces them to choose between helping a woman with a life-threatening condition and violating their conscience. This Hobson's choice is intolerable.
She says the doctors are harmed because they've structured their medical practices to bring life into the world.
When they are called from their labor and delivery floor down to the operating room to treat a woman suffering from abortion drug harm, that is diametrically opposed to why they entered the medical profession. It comes along with emotional harm.
Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson sounded skeptical. She says federal law already gives the doctors protection against conscience injury, but the lawsuit is asking for more than that.
They're saying because we object to having to be forced to participate in this procedure, we're seeking an order preventing anyone from having access to these drugs at all. And I guess I'm just trying to understand how they could possibly be entitled to that given the injury that they have alleged.
A majority of the nine justices seem to lean against the abortion opponents. They also heard from lawyer Jessica Ellsworth, who argued on behalf of Danko Laboratories, a petitioner alongside the FDA.
Respondents' view of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is so inflexible it would upend not just Mifeprix, but virtually every drug approval and REMS modification FDA has made for decades.
Solicitor General Prilligar agrees, saying that ruling for the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine would harm both the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry, and she says it would also harm women across the nation.
Rolling back FDA's changes would unnecessarily restrict access to mifepristone with no safety justification. Some women could be forced to undergo more invasive surgical abortions. Others might not be able to access the drug at all. And all of this would happen at the request of plaintiffs who have no certain injury of their own. The court should reject that profoundly inequitable result.
The Supreme Court is expected to issue its ruling by the summer. In the meantime, it will hear one more abortion case involving hospital emergency treatment in states that ban abortions. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Jumpshot Jordan. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Metz, Kelly Lincoln, Sarah Reif, and Christopher Martinez. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Musick.